This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're continuing our series of conversations with authors up for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. Today, we're exploring the fiction category. In this hour, we have all five authors on the shortlist for the fiction prize. We'll start today with Brian Allen Carr, who wrote the novel Opioid Indiana. I spoke with him earlier this week. Brian Allen Carr, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, man.
Without giving anything away, what's this novel about?
Basically, it's about a kid who's in foster care. His foster guardians are addicts. He's suspended from school for a week. And then, you know, adventure ensues.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, leaves a lot on the table. Okay. Well,
sure.
I mean, how did this story get into your head or out of your head, I guess, as it were?
I'm always kind of curious about how different generations kind of view the world. And so this is about a 17-year-old. And I'm kind of really interested in the ideas of borders. I come from the Texas-Mexico border. And I think one of the most significant borders of our generation is the digital divide. And so I was kind of curious. I'm always kind of curious about how young people sort of navigate the world with all the technology that they have at their disposal. My youth, I'm 41 now, so my teenage years, I knew what the internet was, but I don't think we had it in my house until, you know, maybe toward the end of my high school. And it definitely wasn't like it is now. You know, I mean, we didn't have streaming audio. You couldn't watch a video on the internet. I remember one time I asked a guy if he ever thought there would be internet radio, and he was like, no, there's no way. It's too much. And then like 4 years later, of course, there was. And then I'm just kind of curious about how younger people view the world, well, our country, and what growing up in it is like, just because I feel that with the advent of the internet and with, you know, the addiction that most people have to using the internet, chiefly social media, that it must really color the way that they see the world. And so a big portion of this book is tied in some ways to that. Riggle, the main character, interfaces with the internet quite a bit at the beginning, and then he's in a situation where he's run out of data. He's not allowed to use too much data. He's on a strict plan. And then so it's kind of like then another border emerges where it's like him thinking about the world when he has the internet and then him thinking about the world when he does not.
I mean, so. Your character is also this transplant from Texas, just like
you. Yeah, 100%. And realistically, the only reason I did that is because I wanted to write a timely book. I wanted to set it here in Indiana because, one, I live here, and two, I wanted to explore something new in writing. Most of my other stuff has been set in Texas. But I didn't feel like I had the authority to write about somebody who had grown up in Indiana. I still don't. I'm pretty particular about who writes about what places and how they go about doing it. So, right, like the first sentence in this novel starts, I'm from Texas, but most of this story takes place in Indiana. Mm. Because it's, in my opinion, my philosophy, in my morality, I'm not allowed to write about places that I'm not from as though I'm from there. Mm. It's against my moral code.
Well, so he comes here and he experiences an Indiana that's not exactly positive and definitely complicated. What did you want this Indiana to feel like to the reader?
Sure. I mean, I would take umbrage with that a little bit because I don't necessarily think that he sees Indiana is negative at all. The weather's different, the people are different, but when he talks about back home, he speaks about them in exactly the same manner. 17-year-olds don't like where they live, period.
Yeah.
Maybe if you live in New York or San Francisco and your parents are rich, but other than that, you're going to want to leave where you're at 17, and the way that looks is you badmouth where you live. And so I think he definitely talks about the difference between the demographics of here versus Texas. Though that said, he's talking about rural Indiana, right? So if he was in Indianapolis proper, the discussion would be slightly different. But I mean, if he had come from a happy home, it just wouldn't be as a negative event, right? Because I could have written about this exact same place, but through the eyes of somebody who was from a happy home. and then maybe the title wouldn't be Opioid Indiana. It would be like, you know, Happyville, Indiana, or whatever. But most people don't see the place that they live in as a place. They see it through the filter of their experiences. And because his experience has been not a happy one, I mean, he really, there is no other option for him if you're going to write about him in any kind of realistic manner than for him to have a semi-negative view about the world around him, period. Mm. He just happens to be in Indiana. But it's not, I mean, again, go find me a 17-year-old who's like, I live in the best place ever. Maybe if they're from a super happy home, but other than that, that's just, it's not realistic at all.
Our minds are sort of off the opioid crisis right now because of the pandemic, but the opioid crisis is definitely still there. You've certainly thought about how people are navigating it. I mean, you wrote the book, but what, or maybe who, do you think about when it comes to living in this world where so many people have this need to check out of the real world with these drugs?
I mean, myself, I struggle with addiction myself. And when I was 13 years old, I broke my ankle really badly and I was put in a hospital and rigged up to a Demerol machine, and I could press a button every 5 minutes. And I did. And then, you know, when I left, I got a prescription for pills. I think it was Vicodin. And pretty much ever since then, you know, I've had some sort of struggle with something. It's kind of funny. People have said, you know, how did you research for this book? Or people have also like, gotten upset that the book doesn't have as much to do with opioids as they think it's supposed to, which that's insane to me. And they'll call it a poorly researched book. And I'm like, bro, you have no idea. You have no idea.
Well, what do you think makes them say that after having read it?
Childishness. I don't know. People see what they want to see. One time I saw Tim O'Brien read How to Tell a True War Story, and that's like one of the most anti-war stories of all times. And then right afterwards, a guy came up who was enlisted, and he was like, I can't wait to go over to Iraq and, you know, and participate in war. That's not what he said. But Tim was like, what is wrong with you? But like most people, and this is indicative of our times, really, right? People decide the facts that they want to believe. They decide the reality that they want to see. They foist their own opinions onto the actions of others. And that's just what folks do. We're kind of set up to be that way. It's unfortunately, it's getting worse and worse as we've become more and more tribal.
Your character is old enough to fend for himself, obviously, but still, of course, young enough to be really vulnerable to this time. I mean, he's still very much in his formative years. What do you think is happening to these opioid adjacent children in the real world? I mean, if we could look at this through a somewhat optimistic lens, or maybe even not, what kind of people do you see them becoming?
I mean, it's hard to say. They're always going to become who they become based upon who it is that they are inside. There are plenty of people who are from addicted families who go on to be fantastic human beings. But then also too, I mean, I think to paint it into the corner of it just being about opioids. I mean, most children today have parents who are addicted to something. Most of them are addicted to, like, the internet, really. I wonder what that looks like to a kid, you know, right? If you're 10 years old and your parents are just thumb typing on Facebook all the time, you know? I mean, and then, like, if you look at, like, get on Facebook and look at, like, neighborhood groups, you know, those are parents. And I have no idea what their kids must think of when they see. Most people in America have some sort of habitual behavior that they wish they didn't have, and that makes their life way more complicated than it needs to be. And kids grow up with some element of that, regardless of how drastic it is. And then that's the job of every human being ever to like try to navigate the pains that they've had in the past and try to harness something positive out of that and look for a better way to behave in their own lives.
Does that correlate, or is there a parallel there with your own character that you've written?
I think that correlates with everybody. And again, I mean, I know that's super general and maybe I'm being stereotypical of the human experience or whatever, but I mean, I think that, you know, especially at that formative age, right? Because this would be, I guess, considered a Bildungsroman, that, you know, you're at a crossroads. Again, I'm super interested in borders. 17 is about as big of a border year as you can get, right?
Sure.
So, like, Not only are you not, you're right, you're on the precipice of being able to vote, being able to smoke, being able to join the army, but you're still sort of like in that other place where realistically, right, 17-year-olds in our society have a fairly large decision to make based upon, you know, what they're going to do once they get out of high school. And it's unfortunate how much weight we put on that year for children's lives, right? We've seen this in the, in that, like, Hollywood scandal where, like, all these people were trying to rig admissions for their kids to get into upper-tier schools because at the age of 17, right, you apply to a college, and the college that you get into dictates so much about how the world perceives you in terms of your worth, right? Like, so if you're 17 and you get an acceptance letter to Harvard, right, then the world around you sees you as way more valuable. Well, that's really more of a reflection on your parents than anything else, right? But, you know, so it's just that's an odd year. It's way too heavily weighted in our society. It's just a super weighty time.
This is not your first book, so I feel kind of strange asking this. This is more of a debut author's question, but what is... Okay. What is writing for you, or maybe what has it been throughout your life and then later your career?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so it's interesting. My dad was a preacher, and I kind of view writing as a secular sort of religion. And it's always kind of been this thing where I seek out answers to this crazy life in a variety of different places. One of the places that I always found that yielded the best answers was books. And a lot of the people who I gravitated to at a young age were people who had complicated lives. And even though they had complicated or tragic lives, they were able to discern some sort of beauty out of that. And then I think what I do as a writer is I try to work in that tradition wherein I take the struggles from my own life. I filter them through some sort of philosophy, whatever that philosophy might be at the time, or however I'm thinking about the world, whatever I'm reading, or whatever art I'm immersed in. And then I try to force my experiences through those filters as a way of trying to help myself cope with the world around me. And then also there's an element where, you know, I'm trying to then reach out to others in some way, pay it forward, try to produce something that is of interest and that can maybe speak to somebody else's struggles.
Brian Allen Carr is the author of Opioid Indiana, and he's one of the authors up for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award for Fiction. Brian, thanks for your time today.
Hey, man, no problem. Thank you.
Up next, sometimes all you need to make your story work is a different perspective. We'll hear from an author who fought the urge to turn the villain into the protagonist. And later, a satirical comment on the government controlling our personal lives. Today we're talking to all five authors up for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the fiction category. I'm Matt Pelsert. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelsert. Today we're continuing our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards, which will be handed out September 1st. This hour we're hearing from all five authors in the fiction category. And right now we have my interview with Chris White, who wrote The Life List of Adrian Mandrick. Chris White, welcome to All In.
Thank you so much. Just delighted to be here.
So this is your first novel?
This is my first novel, yeah. I had started out as a playwright and a screenwriter, and also actually was in the music business for quite a while. But I've been working on this quite a few years, and yeah, it's my debut novel.
So what's it about? Can you give me a quick off-the-cuff synopsis?
So it's about an anesthesiologist who's married, has two children, lives in Boulder, Colorado. And he's one of the top birders in the North American birding region, which means he has actually the third longest life list of species seen over the course of his life of anyone in this region. And he gets a call early on in the book from his estranged mom. He immediately hangs up, and it brings up a lot of issues for him that sort of compel him even more into his obsession with finding the bird and being the top of the list of birders. At a certain point, a certain bird seems to have been spotted that he then spends much of the book going after rather than dealing with any of these issues that are being brought up for him. He also has a bit of a problem with painkillers and things like that he kind of goes back into. There is humor in the book, though, I want to say. I know it sounds all very intense, But it's I hope it's humorous as well.
Okay, so is that then a parallel, the fact that he's sort of chasing these birds and he's also sort of, well, chasing a high in being a pill addict?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, he definitely spends some time trying not to be certain places in his head. So I think both of those things kind of are seemingly good ideas for him to do that. At least he thinks so.
As I understand it, this book did what a lot of novels do. It started as one thing and it turned into something else. How did it change as you were writing it?
I think the very first piece of it came when I was, you know, that classic situation of I'm on a plane next to a stranger, and somehow or other, the stranger ended up telling me the story of a birder. I wasn't even really thinking about birders in my life at that time, but he told me the story of a top level birder who had gotten word of a certain important species that was in a couple states over, and he got in his car with his wife, and the two of them were quickly driving toward this bird, and they stopped to get gas, and he got back in the car and forgot his wife at the gas station.
Oh my goodness.
Going for a couple of hours before he remembered. And so I don't know, that story, I was going through really rough times with my own marriage at the time, and there was something about that story that made me feel like very compelled by that character and by that scenario, I guess. And it really is what sent me down this path.
So the main perspective went from one character to another as you were writing it. And of course the story came about in the way you just described, but how much did you fight that? I mean, I feel like I would have gotten mad at the book as I was writing it. Like, no, I want to tell this story.
Well, yeah, it started off actually in had multiple perspectives, but the main perspective was the perspective of Adrian's wife for a number of drafts. And it just kind of kept pecking at me like a woodpecker, that Adrian's story was the one that was drawing my focus more and more. And ultimately he became, you might say, a sort of antagonist in the original several drafts, and then over time became the protagonist. Mm.
What finally made you decide to give in and tell it the way you ultimately did?
Well, there were a couple phases of it. At one point in the progress of writing the book, I just sort of had gotten to the point where I was spending all this time on his perspective and he was starting to take over, but there were still these other perspectives, or a number of them. I think there were like five or six perspectives, different characters whose points of view we learned the story through. And so I had started realizing that it was more his story sort of on my own. And then there came a point where a visiting writer to the DePauw Kelly Writer series, Robert Boswell, very, very famous veteran novelist, I met him and he offered to read the book. A couple of days later, got back to me and just said in this beautiful set of notes that he sent me that, you know, were a godsend, said, yeah, you're right, it's his story, but everybody else needs to go and it needs to be completely his story.
Oh, really? So you jettisoned all the other perspectives?
Yep.
Wow.
And that was a very big revision process. And I was, you know, and even he said, some of the most beautiful stuff is going to be cut. Mm. And you need to figure out how you're gonna put that into his perspective somehow, or get rid of it, or whatever you need to do. And so I did it, and I felt that he was right. And then eventually it became the book it is now.
Was it a therapeutic endeavor?
It was a bit therapeutic in certain ways. I mean, I think mirroring that story that I just told you, I did end up divorcing from my husband at the time. Mm. And I'm remarried now to the writer, Tom Chiarella. But it was sort of an interesting, not that the book is the story of that, because it really isn't. But still, that sense of having been the wife in that situation and going through a number of things that were really difficult. I think I was mad at the sort of husband character initially, and over time had to come to really, became compelled really with trying to really empathize and understand what might happen in a marriage from the other point of view, and not only to make him a believable character, but to be the character that we come to understand and really see the journey of the book through.
There's a strong environmental message in the book. What is it, and how did you weave it into the story?
It's really, really essential to it. You know, I mean, it's sort of the other side of the sword to the story. Obviously, we have the vehicle of Adrian's obsession with bird species. And of course, as he's doing so, he's on some level trying to hurry up because they're disappearing. The species are literally disappearing daily in our time. You know, though he has some personal challenges that make us not really love him initially, perhaps at certain points in the book, he also has this great tenderness and yearning for the sort of the beauty and fragility of life on the planet. So yeah, so we see a lot of his journey through that metaphor of the birds, and then sort of underlying that, yeah, is just climate change and the urgency of our need to sort of change and to also really acknowledge what's broken before we can do so.
Are you comfortable telling us what's next in your career?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I started working on another book not long after that, the Life List of Adrian Mandrake was published, and actually have completed what I think is a pretty good draft, and got that to my agent actually just before COVID hit.
Ah.
So it's a little like for many of us, the timing of a pandemic has not been convenient, to put it mildly, and devastating in many, many ways. So I'm just sort of like, yeah, I can wait. We'll see what happens. And, you know, much of the industry, especially fiction, from what my agent tells me, has been kind of to a crawl or to a halt for the time being. But I'm excited. I'm excited to work on it more with an editor once if that happens. I sort of went the complete other direction with the book. You know, after spending so many years with this man, this protagonist in my book, this is all female perspective in this new book. And there are a number of, I'm back to the several points of view.
Well, it sounds like you got to do what you originally wanted to do in telling it from multiple perspectives, and you got to write a book more from a perspective that maybe you were more used to. Do you feel like that's the case with this next one?
You know, the truth is, I think I've always had the most challenges dealing with characters like myself. I started out also doing some acting earlier in my life, and I always found that to be the case. If the character was more different from me, the easier it was for me to play.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's a big challenge to write all these female perspectives in a different kind of way than was writing his. I mean, but they're all quite different from each other. So yeah, I really liked doing it, and we'll see where it goes from here, I guess.
Chris White is the author of The Life List of Adrian Mandrake, and she's up for Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award. The winners will be announced September 1st. Chris White, thanks and best of luck.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And now for a little satire. Brian Leung is a professor of English at Purdue. He's written novels, nonfiction, poetry, and the entry that got him on this year's list of the Indiana Authors Awards is Ivy versus Dog with a Cast of Thousands. Brian Leung, welcome to All In.
Oh, thank you so much.
So this novel confronts some big issues. Tell me about it.
Well, let's start with the fact that there might be a talking plant. There might be two teenagers running for political office, and one of those teenagers might be pregnant, and there might be a giant squid. There also might be a committee of townspeople who feel like they have a moral obligation to tell everyone how to run their lives. And one of those teenagers I just mentioned, who's running for political office, is Ivy. She's running against Dog, and it's revealed that Ivy is pregnant. And this committee of, quote, do-gooders and the rest of the town feel like they should weigh in at every moment on what Ivy should be doing about her pregnancy. So it's kind of a, I think, funny and respectful conversation about the situation of a woman being pregnant and what her options are.
And the committee is who tells the story, right?
The novel is told through the voice of the committee. And if I've done my job right, my readers will laugh at them and be annoyed at them simultaneously.
Well, I think that idea, the idea of a committee being the voice of a story, especially a satire, is just funny on its own. Was that something you set out to do from the get-go, or did it kind of evolve into that?
Well, it evolved into that because when I originally conceived of this novel, I was coming at it from a place of kind of advocacy of my own, and it just sounded like I was finger wagging. And then I realized, oh, well, that's a good impulse, the finger wagging, but it shouldn't come from me, because that's an annoying trait, right?
Right.
And so I was like, oh, what can I do with that annoying trait? I mean, in the novel, which has nothing to do with the plot, the committee basically puts post-it notes around town, and they say things like, you know, dumb stuff like body hair may become public knowledge, groom, you know, support the local library, but monitor librarians, you know. And so I got to have fun with them, but also hopefully shine a light on when the assumptions that we have about what's right and wrong can have kind of like serious impacts on innocent lives.
The topiaries are a curious part of this book, kind of characters in themselves. What made you want to use topiaries in that way?
Well, there's a woman who's in this novel who is the last remaining child, Abigail Colton, of one of the original people from this town. And she lives in a stately home, and her hobby is growing topiaries. And each year, everyone looks forward to seeing these new topiaries in her front yard. And this year, the year Ivy and Dog are running for the title of Junior Mr. Mayor in Mudlick, Abigail Colton does a masterpiece topiary, and it's a little girl topiary named Fern. And people are so attracted to this topiary, to Fern, that they begin to believe that she speaks to them. And I'm loath to say more about that plot element.
sure.
But they don't think that Fern, they don't put words in Fern's mouth. They think that she's expressing herself. And then, because they believe in that thing, Abigail Colton has an even bigger surprise in store for this town, perhaps in the form of an even more impressive topiary.
And is that the squid that might just be in this book?
I
guess we'll have to. Okay.
You just take a look at the cover of the novel, and you just come to your own conclusions. Although I will say the cover of the novel is a beautiful cover, but I'm aware nobody needs to write me an email that the cover of the novel is not a giant squid, it's an octopus. Yes, I know that.
10-4. All right. Well, so you've written quite a bit over your career. Would you say that this novel is a departure from what you've done before, or is it comfort zone adjacent?
That's a really interesting question when a writer thinks about the trajectory of their career. When I graduated, well, I'm, you know, as you said, I just now ended my term as director of creative writing at Purdue University, you know, and so now I guess I'm an elder statesman. But I started my career down at Indiana University in the MFA program. And then at that moment, you know, I was writing short fiction, and it was kind of very, very deeply literary, and it was good fiction, but kind of humorless. And then I wrote a couple of quite serious novels, Take Me Home is the stronger of those, which is about the historical event of a massacre of Chinese miners in Rock Springs, Wyoming in 1882. Your listeners might want to know that I'm half Chinese. And so that was kind of my, that was kind of my mode and what people expected of me. And so this book really is, what really was, is kind of a shift. And I will tell you the reason why it kind of came to be is because so many of my friends and relatives complained to me that they didn't see me in my books. Cause I'm kind of playful and fun and, you know, a pretty cheery fellow. You know, I think deep thoughts, which is why my other fiction is so serious. And so I was, this book is Ivy versus Dog is, was kind of a chance for me to see if I could put my playfulness into a serious subject.
Well, it's a great book. Brian Lee Young is the author of Ivy versus Dog with a cast of thousands. He's, of course, up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award for fiction. Winners will be announced September 1st. Brian, best of luck, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, and I listen to you every afternoon.
That's awfully, I appreciate that. Today, we're talking to all five authors up for the Fiction Prize, and up next, some Indiana sci-fi and a thriller set in the region. That's in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our talks with the authors up for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards in the fiction category. The winners will be announced on September 1st. Michael Martone wrote The Moon Over Wapakoneta, Fictions and Science Fictions from Indiana and Beyond. And he joins us now. Hi, Michael.
Hello. So you got the name, Wapakoneta. That's great.
I mean, I love the title. Wapakoneta, of course, is Neil Armstrong's hometown, about 30 minutes east of the Indiana border in Ohio. I mean, this is a collection of short stories, but what's this one about? Is that the first one in the book?
Yeah, no, it's not the first one. I don't think it, well, maybe it is. I'll have to look at the book. It's a science fiction book, but it's based on Indiana science fiction. And Indiana science fiction is not much happens in Indiana today, and in the future, not much is going to happen either. except things will be, the stuff will be better. And so in The Moon Over Wapakoneta, when I was growing up in Fort Wayne, we would go over to Ohio at 18, you could drink beer. And so in the future, teenage kids in Indiana are still going over to Ohio to get cheap 3-2 beer. And they feel in a drunken state, sort of left behind in the middle of nowhere. And in the future, that feeling of being left behind increases because the moon is being settled. And so the story is about a drunk Fort Wayne kid over in Ohio looking at the moon and feeling very lonely, even though he knows exactly where he is because of the super GPS of the future.
That's
what the story is. Not much happens. He gets drunk.
But it's still this sort of beautiful, stark escapism that I just love the idea of that. So you also have Amish astronauts in this book?
Yes, Amish in space. and in the future in Indiana, the Amish have become sort of like a zoo. People go to look at them, which they're already doing now.
Yeah, yeah.
And looking back into history, it's sort of played out now as far as agriculture goes for the Amish, but NASA wants to settle a planet and they want to terraform the planet and they need people who understand how to work with plants and animals. And so they come to the Amish and they say, would you like to do this? And the Amish say, yeah, I think we will. We'll get out of here. They said just two things. The rockets have to be painted black. And the NASA people say, no, they have to be black and white so we can take pictures of them. And the Amish say, of course, no pictures. And so the story is told by a lot of different Amish people. They head out into outer space. They train to be astronauts. They head out to outer space. And for me, the interesting thing of that story, they never get to the other planet. They're sort of become Amish, lost in space. The interesting thing was that I discovered the Amish idea of time and how in space, the time-space continuum, you know, is always there in science fiction stories, but that they are actually using the rockets to get closer to a kind of heaven where on Earth they sort of use their farm as a kind of rocket to get them on Earth, to get them closer to heaven. So again, it's very poetic as opposed to being narrative or in telling a story. It's more lyrical and thoughtful and wistful.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you've written a lot of short stories set in Indiana. I mean, this one's sort of partially set in Indiana and partially set in outer space. But
in outer space.
What does Indiana, the setting, do for you creatively?
Well, I like Indiana for a lot of reasons. One of them is, and I have a book of nonfiction called The Flatness. One thing about Indiana, of course, as you know, is that Indiana, crossroads of America, has a lot of different environments. And so even within Indiana, my Indiana has to do with the sort of flatness of the northeastern part. To me, the very subtle nature of what goes on in Indiana, you know, not grand gestures, but all sort of submerged and, you know, like in southern Indiana, like the disappearing rivers that go underground. Mm-hmm. To me, that leads to these kinds of stories that are very subtle and understated, with only occasionally, you know, vertical grain bins or windmills or, you know, other thing, airplanes that take off, you know, above this flat plain. So that's one reason I like the Midwest, and I like its quietness and its contemplation about itself.
Do you think enough people write about Indiana for those reasons?
Well, I'm now living in Alabama. I've lived here 24 years, which is more time than I actually lived in Indiana. And what's interesting as a teacher of writing, when I ask my students here, you know, what are they going to write about? They say, well, I'm going to write about Alabama. But if I go up to Fort Wayne and I say, well, I write about Indiana, most people will say, well, why? And it does strike me that Indiana and Hoosiers have as part of their nature not thinking about Indiana as a subject, whereas in the South they're all in. They think it's really great and we have terrific stories, but Indiana, we sort of hedge our bets. We think, oh yeah, we're just in the middle of nowhere, as I said before. And so that's another reason that I like writing about Indiana, is that flatness is also a sort of wide open, that the stories that we tell each other are there, but we don't think of them as important. And I like to think that the stories I tell that are about Indiana, that people in Indiana know and share, can actually be invigorated, can actually be brought to an importance in the way, say, other parts of the country feel their stories and their lives are important.
Michael Martone is the author of The Moon Over Wapakoneta, Fictions and Science Fictions from Indiana and Beyond. And he's up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award for Fiction. Michael Martone, thanks and best of luck.
Thank you.
And finally, from the fiction category, we'll hear from Brian Ferunas. He wrote the novel Do Not Go On. Brian, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get to your book, we just got off the line with fellow Indiana Authors Award nominee Michael Martone, who you've actually worked with before. What did you do with him?
Oh, I met Michael in my graduate program. He was teaching there when I was a student, and we connected because we're both Hoosiers. For a long time, I kept my eye out for a project that we could both work on. And we came up with an idea called Winesburg, Indiana, this fictional town populated by a lot of gripers and complainers and kvetchers, but who do it usually in an entertaining way. And Michael wrote a bunch of stories in the voice of citizens from this town. And I invited other authors who had some connection to Indiana to write stories around this theme as well. And then ultimately we packaged it up into a book called Winesburg, Indiana. And that was my first anthology that I edited.
So, I mean, Michael's a short story guy. Are you as well?
That's where I started. And I love to write short stories. I've mainly focused on novels for the past decade. But I'd like to think that I have one foot in the world of short stories and one foot in the world of novels.
So let's talk about this novel, Do Not Go On. What's it about?
It's about a family in the witness protection program. There's a father and daughter who are whisked away from Baltimore to the tiny town of Morocco, Indiana. And the instant they get there, the father starts losing his mind from paranoia, takes up residence in the oak tree in the yard with a rifle because he's convinced that the people who are after him are going to find him and come get him. So it's up to the 17-year-old girl, Anna, to hold everything together and to try to figure out what's really going on with her father's situation. And all of this is set against the backdrop of her college search and her SATs. So she's trying to figure out her future in addition to figuring out what's happened in the past.
This sounds like a very unique coming of age story. Is that kind of the genre you'd put this in?
Yeah, a little bit. It's kind of a mix of genres. It's got elements of a coming of age story. It's also got elements of a thriller.
Oh, sure.
Some of my favorite works are works that blend genres or have one or part literary fiction, but also are thrilling and exciting.
What made you want to write about this particularly?
Well, I mentioned grad school once already, and at the risk of being redundant, I'll go back to that because that's where this idea came from. I had a teacher in grad school who told me a story. She interviewed Gerald Schur, the guy who created the Witness Protection Program.
Ah.
And she had a whole series of interviews with him because she was working on an article. And the idea for the article was that Gerald Schur was the ultimate fiction writer because he created characters that came to life. And I was fascinated by this idea. She ended up losing faith in the idea of the article, and she never wrote the article. But I really was interested in this idea, so I asked her if I could listen to the tapes, and she said no.
Oh, no, why?
Well, she never told me why exactly. when I couldn't get the tapes, the idea was still in my head, and I was wondering, you know, what would it be like to create characters who come to life, and what would that power do to somebody? And because I didn't have the tapes, I had to make it up for myself. And that's how I started writing this book. So ultimately, I think my teacher knew what she was doing.
Okay. I mean, Morocco, though, that's a real town in northwestern Indiana. Why set the book there?
I spent a little bit of time in Morocco. My first job out of college was doing social work for Kankakee Valley Workforce Development Services. And my job was to help people on welfare get jobs. So most of the time I worked in Rensselaer, but once a week I had to spend a day in the Morocco office, which was even smaller. So I'd go over to Morocco and just spend the entire day alone in the office. No one ever came in the entire year that I worked there. And that town fascinated me because I couldn't figure it out. It just seemed like the loneliest town that I had ever been in, or maybe that was just me at that time. And it also had some interesting stories about it. The unofficial nickname of the town is Chicago's Mob Burial Ground.
Ooh.
Because once every few years, there will be a body that turns up in some poor farmer's cornfield, and it's never a local body. So that that little detail lodged in my brain, and I always knew I was going to use it in some book.
Do you feel like you captured that sort of lonely tone of Morocco that you felt when you worked there?
I think that's a good question. I can tell you that I think I captured my version of Morocco or my experience in Morocco. But I do wonder, you know, if you asked people in Morocco if that's their Morocco, I think some people might say yes, but other people might say no.
Hmm. Have you gotten any feedback from readers?
I have, yeah. And it comes in various ways. You know, sometimes you see reviews on Amazon or Goodreads. Sometimes readers will drop you a note. A book club in Sweden read my book. And then one person Zoomed with me and gave me a recap of all the feedback. I wasn't sure what to do with that, but I was glad that they read it.
And when it came to writing, I guess, the stories of these people who went into the witness protection program, I mean, I don't know. I've wondered about that myself. Did you find yourself getting lost in some of the details, like as you were writing it? I mean, what ended up was good, of course, but I always feel like if you're writing that sort of thing, you almost feel this need to be too detailed. Did you experience that?
I didn't. I'm not the kind of writer who does all the research up front, maybe because I'm afraid that I would just drown in all the details and ultimately be unable to write the story. I'm the kind of writer who lets the story lead the way, and then I go in search of details when I need them. And what I'm hoping for is the kind of magic that a writer feels when you find just the right detail that doesn't fit exactly what you're looking for, but alters the story in a really interesting way. So you go looking for one thing, but you find something else that's even better than what you're looking for. And, you know, some of those, some of the big research questions I had almost felt like a game that I was playing or a puzzle that I was solving.
Why do you like to write about Indiana?
I bet you asked Michael the same thing. and I'll be really interested when I listen to all of this to hear his answer. My answer is that I don't think that I can help it. I have lived in Indiana all but 6 months of my life. I love Indiana in the way that you might love a dog that is like half bald and pees itself when the doorbell rings. You know, this love is real, but also I don't idealize Indiana, but it's in me deep. My Hoosierness goes bone deep. So
Brian Furunas is the author of Do Not Go On, and he's up for a Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the fiction category. The winners will be announced September 1st. Brian, best of luck, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk with you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. A big thanks to Indiana Humanities for helping us out with our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards. And we will have another episode with some authors on Monday in the genre category. And our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss a topic you care about. And find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana for discussion and daily topic alerts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening and happy reading. This is All In.